Good to have you come out tonight. We're going to pick up right where we left off last week. I'll do a little quick review because we really still have a lot to cover. You got to kind of get through all this for us to make some headway. So if everybody's ready and buckled in, we're still in last week's notes. So there are no notes for this week. I'm calling this session 4, and that means that for the rest of the series, you're going to be confused because session 4 in your notebook is going to be on the soul, but we'll keep you caught up as we move along. All right, so we're still talking about the constitution of man, and tonight we're going to focus on conditional unity, which really we were silent on for 2 weeks, and then I kind of sprung it on you at the end of the last session. But here's where we've been. There are traditionally among Christians 3 views of what it means to be a human. 3 views of how we are made up. All right? And so we've talked about these. The first one is monism or monism. And that's the belief in Christian tradition that a human being is a whole, complete being. You're either alive or you're dead. And in particular, that idea comes out when you die. When you die, from this tradition, your body and your soul and your spirit all reside in the grave in whatever form that is. And the anticipation or the hope is not some intermediate state, but rather the resurrection. All right? So that they're not. There are some crazy folks out there that believe that, but we're really focusing on Orthodox Bible-believing believers, and some would hold to that position, that anytime the Bible talks about parts of the human, it's really just different ways to address what it means to be human, but we are complete. We are unified. The other is the idea of not monism, but dualism, and there are 2 different views. Both of these would be dualism. There's dichotomy, believing there's a material part and an immaterial part. When you die, the material, your body, lies in the grave. The immaterial part, your soul, spirit, goes up and lives in this intermediate state. And then at the resurrection, your body is joined to your soul. Also dualism, trichotomy, they're really identical to dichotomy, except the trichotomist would see 3 parts, major essential parts that make up the constitution of a human: body, soul, and spirit, being soul and spirit being themselves distinct. At death, the soul and the spirit go to be in the presence of the Lord, and the body awaits the resurrection. Okay, that's a review. It took us a couple of weeks to cover all that, but we did it there in just about 2 or 3 minutes. All right? Now, these definitions you have in your notebook, I brought these forward, but if you were to look back, you could find the definition of monism and those that would traditionally follow that. You can find the definition of dualism. Most of Orthodox Christianity are dualism, divided between dichotomist and trichotomist. Dichotomy simply means 2 parts. Trichotomy means 3 parts. Okay? So that's where we are. Everybody caught up? That's what we've talked about thus far in the 2 or 3 weeks that we've been together. So now, tonight, we want to spend some time talking about conditional unity. I left you there last week. It's at the end of last week's notes. What is conditional unity? So as a definition, this is what we're talking about. This position affirms both the essential unity of the material and immaterial part of man and the existence of an intermediate state. Now, I want to stop right there because this opening sentence, if you were to take what we've covered so far, is a suggestion that the monists are right when they speak of the human as having an essential unity, as a singular thing, and that the dualists are right when they speak of the immaterial parts separating from the body at death. So this is, it's not really a hybrid, but just to get you thinking this way, it's taking the essential unity from the monism position and the necessity of an intermediate state after death where the soul and spirit goes of the dualist position. It's bringing those 2 together. And this is this next statement, next sentence, very important. From this position, a person does not have a body and a soul, but a person, a human being, is a body and a soul. Neither of those make up a complete person. All right, now, that's pretty simply stated, but based on all that we've talked about in the two sessions before this, I want to see if you're kind of following what's being suggested here. Regularly, we've talked about how many parts does a human being have? And we said, well, maybe there's just one part, maybe there's two, maybe there's three, maybe there's more. But this is saying, wait a minute, when you talk that way, you're always going to have to wrestle with which one is the human. A human with parts, and the question becomes, if the parts are separated, which one of them is still the human? And we played with that a little bit last week even. We talked about that. When a person dies, where am I? Where is the me that is me? Am I in the dust or am I in heaven? And when we're in a Christian room like this and we force that, we press that into believers who are somewhat familiar with what the Bible teaches, we just naturally relax into the idea that I am present with the Lord. Remember, we looked at all those verses last week and we just kept reminding ourselves that it seems to be this suggestion that the me that is me is with the Lord. The problem with that, the camp that would support conditional unity, is you're dividing what it means to be a human and suggesting that you can still be that without your body. That the body becomes, in some sense, inconsequential. Albeit still waiting for the resurrection, but so what? I'm already with the Lord. The me that is me is already present with Christ. So why? Why should I be concerned about the body? It's not arguing that the body's not going to be resurrected, but that it just seems to be unimportant. So what conditional unity is trying to take that idea that evangelicalism has broadly accepted, that the body really doesn't matter, that the me that is me is in heaven, and to say, wait a minute, you've divided humanity, what it means to be a human, in an awkward and even unbiblical way. So Millard Erickson might be attributed with even the phrase conditional unity. Anthony Hekema, Charles Sherlock, and John MacArthur would take this position. To kind of help us see that, biblical doctrine, John MacArthur's systematic theology, here is what he writes at the end of his dealing with all these different perspectives. Yet is there a better designation than dichotomism? Dichotomy, two parts. Since Scripture presents a person as a unified yet complex self, the designation complex unity is preferred. Now, I highlighted that because this is the phrase he uses, but it's equal to this phrase. And he'll bring that up in a moment. The material, body, and immaterial, soul, spirit, function together in one person, embracing both unity and diversity. This complex unity is conditional, and that's where that word comes from, since death in a fallen, world separates body and spirit. Yet this separation is temporary, since all people are headed for resurrection, a reunion of the body and spirit in eternal forms. So this is Dr. MacArthur having dealt with monism, dualism, trichotomy and dichotomy, having affirmed dichotomy as his preferred position, then says, is there a better position? And he describes this and would affirm this to be the best way to consider a human being. So do you see here what MacArthur in his paragraph as well as this definition is trying to do? It's trying to keep us as Christians from separating the soul and the body, and imagining either of them apart can be a human. Either of them apart are not human. They are parts of what it means to be a human. But God speaks of us, created us as a unified, complex being. So we have to think about then tonight a little more carefully this intermediate state. Because if conditional unity is really the right way to look at it, and if Dr. MacArthur's complex unity is the right way to look at it, then we're going to challenge ourselves to think through that a little bit and see whether or not the Bible would support this reality. So far, I'm just wondering, are you following the reasoning here, and does it sound like something that Christianity ought to consider? Obviously, Dr. MacArthur thinks we ought to consider it, and others before him. I'm just interested in how this bounces off of you. Help me. Say something. Mike, seem reasonable? Do you see that there might be an issue that this corrects? An issue among believing Christians? Any of you? Yes. It's clearly important. And what Michael brings up, the resurrection, is really what drives this fairly new perspective of the anthropology of man. And that is, Old Testament and New Testament alike force, press, drive, place so much emphasis in the resurrection that we have to, as Christians, wrestle with the importance of our body, maybe in a fresh new way. That's the idea. This resurrection, every time you hear that, if you're already a dualist, dichotomist or trichotomist, the resurrection doesn't impact your soul or your spirit, at least on face value. It's already in heaven. So the resurrection addresses the body. And that's one aspect of why this new position or newer position has been formed. Any other thoughts about it so far before we kind of work through this? Observations? Anybody? Yeah, so it's not just the resurrection emphasis, but what Dennis is pointing out, and we'll see some of that tonight, is that what the New Testament constantly declares is that I am saved, I am being saved, and I will be saved, and when that will be saved is awaiting the resurrection. So there is a very real sense that Christianity in general should always understand salvation as the need for the body to be itself saved, for the body itself to be redeemed. Otherwise, salvation is incomplete. Now, we've made very comfortable bedfellows with this disunity for many generations in the church now. And most evident is at a funeral, and we'll come back to that in a little bit, but we just regularly disregard the body. We say things. You heard pastors all your life say things like, we know that the body is here, but he isn't. See, we use that language. He's not really here. He's somewhere else. And that's forcing a disunity that's incompatible with either biblical revelation or God's ultimate intention. Then, of course, if it's a body that has suffered cancer, debilitating disease, any of those things, maybe a disability, then we're very, very fond of saying not only is he or she not here, but he or she is there, and she's well now. She's dancing now, or whatever the case might be. There's no more pain now. And while that is true, there's also something else true. She's incomplete. He's not what he wants to be. She's not what she wants to be. All right? So that's the whole notion of conditional unity. Trying to elevate again what it means to be a human, and it requires all those parts. And what it's like to feel divided or be divided, either in this life or the next life. Yes, we're going to touch on that tonight. Very important observation. We know in this life, most of us are old enough in here and have experienced something here to know in this life that there's definitely an inextricable link between the material and the immaterial part, and that they can be affected and can affect one another. The trouble is, at death, we tend to just settle that and as settled and let the body be what the body is. Me, I'm in heaven. And that's what we're really going to work through tonight. And these observations, excellent observations, and we'll work through them here even in just a minute. I saw somebody back here, Mike. It only does in this sense. Conditional unity or complex unity seeks to elevate again in the Christian thinking the importance of the body. But it cannot elevate that importance to the degree that we would at the same time argue against cremation or other things as being fundamentally unbiblical. What we can say is that the Christian tradition has historically found it valuable to offer some degree of preservation to the body, some respect for the body, a particular way the body would be buried, for instance, typically facing the east so that when Christ came, they could stand up and be facing him. All of these things have been a part of Christian history, but are now pretty old Christian history. And it was because there was a strong appreciation for what we're talking about, the resurrection of the body. what we see now with the rise in acceptance among Christians of cremation and other forms of discarding of the body is a reflection not of a sinful idea. We can't build a case for that, and I won't dwell on that, but it is a reflection of the fact that we have diminished or devalued the body. Christians have taken, found a comfortable position where they just almost disregard the body. All right, let's work through this, or we won't finish in our hour, and let's see what we can unpack. All right, so over here we had, if you remember, physicalism. A human is a physical thing in all of its parts. Naturalism, of course, is not Christian, but we've talked about monism. Then over here is dualism in its two parts. So what we're really seeing now is taking a classic dichotomy position, but the trichotomy is compatible also, and bringing that from the monism unity position and saying, here's a more healthy position. And again, this is presenting this as though it's a hybrid, and it really isn't. What I would want to say is what we're talking about with conditional unity is dichotomy or trichotomy rightly understood. But this illustration is to help you think. Unity, monism, separation, dualism, maybe we need to bring those two things back together again. Okay, in conditional unity, this is helpful to think about this. In this life, the human being is this, a complete person, but with sin. I'm talking to all of you as living, breathing human beings, and whatever parts you're made up of are all here tonight, right? Your body is here, and your soul and spirit is here, and that is this life. This life is life as a complete person, but with sin. And we deal with that. It doesn't matter whether you're an unbeliever or a believer, this applies. You're complete and you have sin. Now, at death, what conditional unity wants us to see is you're now an incomplete person, but you don't have sin. You were complete, and that's why you don't walk around, most of us with a degree of mental health and physical health, don't walk around feeling disjointed in this life. But what you'll see tonight from Scripture is that in the life to come, in the intermediate state, you do experience a separation anxiety. You experience an incompleteness, and the Bible shows believers expressing that. The Apostle Paul does it most clearly. They know they're not complete, but yet thankful to have shed this sinful body. They're thankful to be without sin, but they are separated, and they know they're not complete. All right? Another way of looking at it. In this life, we're a fallen person with a fallen nature, and we long to be without sin. That's who we are as Christians. We long to be without sin. When we die, we lose the fallen nature, but now we long to be in a body that is not sinless. There is a longing in the presence of the Lord for a body that is without sin. And at the resurrection, for the first time ever, you will be a complete person without sin. We know nothing of that in this life, not since the fall. All right, all of those are ways of kind of illustrating what we're talking about. So now let's see if we can defend this position with the arguments made by its proponents. Number one, arguments made in favor of dichotomy are compelling because they point to an intermediate state. And I would just simply say that the biblical argument for a separation of the body and the soul is clear. There is definitely a separation at death. That's my biblical conviction. And that forces us to be dichotomist. This is when the immaterial part of man will exist without the body. Therefore, the conditional unity position is in full agreement with the views of dichotomy. Now, I got ahead of myself and I said this already. Conditional unity is dichotomy as far as embracing the same principle. However, notice, the separation made at death between the material and the immaterial is an unnatural separation in which people will long to be united with their body because the body is an essential part of what it means to be a human. The key word there, and you could look at conditional unity or complex unity from others that defend this position, the key word there is when you die, you exist in heaven in the presence of the Lord in an unnatural state. It was not natural for a human to be divided and experience that. Not since creation. So here's the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 4. Really the linchpin text for conditional unity. All the other texts that argue for dichotomy or trichotomy also support this. But this becomes the pivotal text. Look what Paul writes. And I printed it first out of the New American Standard. For indeed, while we are in this tent. What is he talking about? Our body. While we are in this body, we groan, being burdened. Now watch, we would think I groan because, you know, I'm old and weigh too much and my knee hurts. That's the groaning that we have. All creation groans. And certainly this text, he talks about that. But that's not what he's talking about here. Notice, the burden that we have while we're in this tent groaning is because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed. Paul is pointing the believer to something that you almost have never heard mentioned in your Christian experience. He's pointing the believer to the reality that there's a groaning in this life beyond the sinful body that we deal with. There is a groaning in the Christian life because we know that when we die, we're going to be unclothed. And we don't want to be unclothed. We understand that to be separated from the body is to be present with the Lord. But Paul here is pointing us to think this way. It's as though you stand there naked. You're missing something. So that's the groaning he's talking about. So that what is mortal will be swallowed up by life. The mortal is left behind. The immortal goes ahead. And we stand there, as it were, an emperor with no clothes. That's the idea. Now, it's obscure in the NASB. It's not much better in the ESV. Here's the New King James, and it's not much better still. For we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. And now the idea here is, I'm not burdened because I want to be separated, but rather I want to be further clothed. I want my mortality to become immortal. He's really saying, I want my body. I want my body, but I want it redeemed. I want it to be immortal. Now, the New Living Translation, which we go to about every 17 years here, says it this way, and it's helpful. It really is helpful. Our dying bodies make us groan and sigh, but it's not that we want to die and have no bodies at all. We want to slip into our new bodies so that these dying bodies will be swallowed up by everlasting life. Now that's much closer to a commentary than it is a good translation, but it's a good commentary of what the Apostle Paul is saying. All right? So you getting the idea here? This is what the conditional unity position is saying. Paul taught that there is an awkwardness to death, and we need to acknowledge that. And that's how we hold on to the Old Testament and New Testament's insistence on the hope of the resurrection. That there's real hope there, and that hope exists even in heaven. Now, here's the whole text, back to the NASB. For indeed, while we're in this tent, we groan, being burdened, because we don't want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, so that what is mortal will be swaddled up by life. Now, he who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave to us the Spirit as a pledge. Therefore, being always of good courage, and knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight. But we are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord. It seems that the real heart of this text is Paul is really addressing, with the assumption that the typical believer that he's talking to would have understood this, that this to be separated from the body is an unpleasant, groaning experience. And yet the comfort we have, he's saying the comfort we have, is that God designed us for this. And he gave us a Spirit to, as it were, help us abide through the groaning. And we are of good courage because even though this is a burden and even though it's awkward to be unclothed, it's still better to be absent from the body and to be home with the Lord than it is to be trapped in this sinful body. Now we would all agree, and have talked already last week, that the biblical truth to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord is the reality that our soul and spirit are going to be with the Lord at death. But when we take the full context, the reason the Apostle Paul said that is because the believers in his day knew that to die and be separated was a burdensome thing. And he's saying it is burdensome, but it's still better to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. It's still better. But what he would also teach as he pressed this truth to its end is that it's better to be absent from this sinful body and to be present with the Lord, but that's not best. What's best is to have our unified body and soul fully glorified. That's what's best. So those that embrace conditional unity take the Apostle Paul's text, extrapolate it into its context, and say he was driving home a point that apparently fell on Christians' ears in the first century in a way that they understood it. We say it today, and it falls on Christians' ears like, what in the world are you talking about? Groaning in heaven. Uncomfortable being separated from the body. And the simple response would be, that's how far away we have come from appreciating what God created when he created a man, body and spirit, body and soul. It's less than human to be anything other than that. Then in 1 Corinthians 15, this perishable body must put on the imperishable. This mortal body must put on immortality. Now when this perishable puts on the imperishable, and this mortal puts on immortality, then the saying that is written will happen. Death has been swallowed up in victory. This text is hugely significant. And I'll give it to you in just a couple of little bites. When a believer is saved, what are we saved from? To be saved is to be saved from what? Yeah, but the history of humankind would phrase that differently, starting with the warning that God gave Adam if he ate from that tree. Death. The wages of sin is death. All right? So to be saved is to be saved from that. To be saved from death, which would include wrath in the form of eternal death or eternal damnation. But just a simple pass. A simple pass would be that Christians believe that to be saved is to be saved from death. What the Apostle Paul is teaching here is that that salvation will not be realized fully until the resurrection, because that's when death will finally be defeated. So here's the idea, guys. I'll use my mother as an illustration because I'm comfortable doing that. My mother in heaven, she is better to be present with the Lord and absent from the body than she was suffering in this life with sin and cancer and the rest of it. But she knows that she's less than she is intended to be. And listen to me carefully. Don't take me wrong, but take me for what this text says. She is still plagued by death, because the grave still has her body. She's still aware of a less than saved position. Even in the presence of the Lord, and I would argue overwhelmingly certain that there is a resurrection to come. But that resurrection hasn't happened yet. But when it happens, death will no longer have a grip on any saint's soul in heaven today. It'll be swallowed up in victory. All right, so I know this is a little bit of a new way of thinking. Work this out. Think this through. We're not talking in any heretical terms. We're trying to understand what God really teaches and what we must understand about what it means to be human. And that our body really, really matters. And that as long as those bodies are in the grave, death still has a grip. The unredeemed, second argument, the unredeemed will be judged as whole persons. When you stand before the judgment seat of Christ, which believers will not face, i.e. the great white throne judgment that will seal your wrath, but yet Paul has already taught the Corinthians, we will stand before the Lord one day, and we will be kind of tested for our works. What'd you do with that grace I gave you? Was it wood, hay, and stubble that got burned up, or was it gold, silver, and precious stones? Which is it? So there is a judgment. But the point of that, whether redeemed or unredeemed, when somebody stands before God in judgment, they stand before God as a person. body and soul. A complete person stands there, not just a soul, and certainly not just a body. This suggests that the body is an integral part of humanity, so much so that judgment can't happen without it. And I agree with that completely. You cannot be judged without a resurrection, because you have to be a whole person when you stand before God, which, by the way, we saw it even this morning in Scripture. There we will give an account for what? What does the Bible teach, speaking specifically of unbelievers, what we will give as an account for when we stand before God? The deeds done in the body. That's what we'll give an account for. And your body will be present, or the unbeliever's body will be present for that accounting. It's really no different for believers, except that the believer's name is already written in the Lamb's Book of Life and there's no threat. Now, where does this come from? Well, notice Daniel chapter 12. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. I don't suspect this is new for any of you, but there is a resurrection coming for every human being, not just believers. Every human being needs a resurrected body in order to do what? Stand before God. Every human being is awaiting a resurrected body. Look what Jesus said in John 5. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming in which all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and will come forth. Those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life, and those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment. Jesus taught the same thing. There's a resurrection coming for everybody. Every human being who is ever created by God will live forever. They'll either live forever in life, or they'll live forever in death. And the seeming supposition, and not really even a supposition, is that no human being could endure the judgment and wrath of God unless they first had a glorified body in which to endure the wrath and death and judgment for all eternity. And yes, I said glorified body. And we'll come back to that in a minute. It's not just believers that will get a glorified body. It's unbelievers that will also get a glorified body. And just hold on to that, because that might raise questions. I'm guessing it raised questions. Does it raise questions? Well, let me answer that now. In what way does a believer, or is a believer said to have a glorified body at the resurrection? In this way. It will be a body and a soul, wholly redeemed, that will forever bring what? Glory to God. That's what it means to have a glorified body. Doesn't make you like magical, though there are elements of that that we might consider in this life to be magical. But when the Bible speaks of you having a glorified body, it's talking about being a complete person, completely without sin, totally redeemed, and able to bring glory to God for all eternity. Now, unbelievers also will receive a glorified body. And what Jonathan Edwards wrote on this subject, and he probably is given credit for the best articulation of this position, is that the unbeliever will receive a glorified body in which he will or she will forever bring glory to the righteousness of God, while we forever bring glory to the grace of God. Two different aspects or elements of what it means to be God in relation to human beings. His righteousness will judge all mankind, and His grace alone will save any who are saved. And every human being will receive a glorified body, and whether it is in death eternal or life eternal, will forever bring glory to God. Now, that's really profound, as Jonathan Edwards tends to be, but it really is just undergirding, driving deeper to what Jesus clearly taught. You've got to have a body to face what God has in store for you after life. Number three, monistic arguments, which we've... Oh, wait, I should point this out. I threw this in just a little bit ago. Here is that great white throne judgment. We'll do this real quickly. I think we have time. John saw a great white throne and him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead. Remember, by this time in Revelation, there's already been the resurrection of the living. Here he sees the resurrection of the dead. The great and the small standing before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. Okay, so there they are, fully human, judged and giving an account for their deeds. as they stand before the judgment seat of God. And the sea give up the dead which are in it, and death and Hades give up the dead which were in them. And they, all of them, are judged, every one of them according to their deeds. And when we read that, we could go back to what the Apostle Paul says. They're giving an account for deeds done in the body, which is what Paul teaches the Corinthians. Now look, verse 14. After the judgment, after watch, after death has now loosed its grip on all humankind, then death and that grave by which death held them is thrown into the lake of fire. It's not needed anymore. It's gone. No fear for any believer of death anymore. No fear for any believer of death. No fear for any believer of the grave. But watch, there awaits a second death, the lake of fire, into which all of those unbelieving humans will now be cast. What we're delivered from is death, partially as our soul finds its place in the presence of the Lord, but yet death and the grave still holding a grip on our body. Now the resurrection has happened, and the final judgment has happened. And what John is telling us, what God is telling us, is death and the grave is no more. And one might say, well, then it wasn't so bad to be an unbeliever because they got out of death and the grave too. No, now there's a second death. And that's where they will spend all eternity, having received a body which can endure that fire and not be consumed. Everybody with me on that? Okay, so another text that I added, and all of them are making the same point. The monistic arguments that place the emphasis of our hope in the resurrection are compelling. In other words, there's a compelling aspect to that argument that emphasized the resurrection. That's what we looked at some weeks ago. Because both the New Testament and the Old place much emphasis in the resurrection and the coming kingdom, and they do not place, seemingly, any intermediate state of existence or in heaven, any emphasis. So we know this text when Paul speaks to the Thessalonians who have now seen believers die and they're worried what's going to happen to them, and he comforts them. But notice, how does he comfort them? He comforts them by pointing them forward to a resurrection. He does not say, it's really fascinating now that you've been through a few weeks of this when I say this, he does not say, don't worry about them, they're present with the Lord. He doesn't say that. It's true, but that's not his comfort. The comfort that he says we should give to other believers is that one day they will be whole. One day they'll be whole. God won't forget them. In fact, they'll be the first to rise from the grave and be made complete. Paul doesn't put an emphasis on where they are now. He puts an emphasis on where they will be at the resurrection. Matthew 6, pray then in this way. This is important. Even Jesus in his model prayer said, Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come. Now the emphasis there I place now simply to remind us all that even in the Lord's Prayer, what we seek is the physical reality of a kingdom where we, in our bodies, live. So in the context of an anthropological study like we're in, and now we're starting to understand the importance of the body, even the Lord's Prayer takes on a different significance. We're praying for physical reality, not just some spiritual intermediate state where we can apparently abide in some sort of bliss. Okay, what are the positive implications of this position? There's a lot of them. The Bible speaks of a unified self in terms of judgment and redemption. When man fell, he fell as a whole person. It's reasonable that we would think God would inevitably redeem the whole person. When man is redeemed, he is redeemed as a whole person. Already, not yet. Our physical condition is intricately linked to that of our soul and spirit. This was the observation made earlier. When we're unhealthy, when we fail to get proper exercise, or there's a chemical depression, our spirit and soul suffers. So when our body suffers, our soul suffers. We feel that anguish, and it's real. And conversely, the condition of your soul is also intricately linked to your physical condition. If your soul and spirit is troubled, heading off into depression and anxiety, it has a direct and immediate effect on your body. These are just observations, anthropological observations of humanity as we live and breathe, and we can't argue against them. The point tonight is they argue for the unity of what it means to be a human. So let's not worry so much about which part is divided and what, although we do know that it is a great joy to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. But our hope, the Christian hope, is the unification of a redeemed body. Now, catch your breath. 10 minutes left. Dualism. You say, well, we've already talked about dualism. It's the contrast to monism. It includes dichotomy and trichotomy and, we've learned, complex or conditional unity. But there is a kind of dualism that is not Christian. And it has a long history, at least back until the first century of the New Testament church. And it's called Gnostic dualism. All right, so when you hear dualism parlanced out there among Christians of all ilk, you better be sure what dualism they're talking about. Because there are an awful lot of Christians who, whether they do by testimony or not, by practice a form of Gnostic dualism. And I've really been talking about it now for 2 weeks. Here's Gnostic dualism. It believes that man's constitution is physical and spiritual, but the physical body is a burdensome, temporary, and material confinement out of which we long to escape. Now, if that's all we said, and I hadn't already told you Gnostic dualism was not a good thing, you'd read that paragraph and say, sounds like a good thing. Sounds like a Christian thing. This old body, can't wait to get rid of it. But the adherence to this version, now, this next slide up here is from the writers of this theology program in, I think it was first published in 1999 or 2001. Who adheres to that? Here's their answer. Uninformed Christians who haven't yet taken this class. Okay. But the reality is, lots of Christians adhere to that. I'll reference again the funerals. Anytime we say, she's not here, she's gone, she's dancing in heaven, she finally left this old body behind, we are espousing, unless we finish that whole statement, we are espousing Gnostic dualism, the disregard of the human body. And here's the problem. At a funeral, for instance, of which I've presided over many, you're pressed with time, you're pressed with emotion, and we grab just that element. It's fine to say that, but it's better to say, like, now think with me, how would you say this in a funeral? Well, it's better that she's not here in this body, that she is now absent and present with the Lord, but even there she's groaning. Even there she's longing for something more. You see, that's staggering. It's almost an affront. But the reality is that's the biblical truth that points to the great hope that everybody in that room that day has, believer or non-believer, the hope of a resurrection. That was always the testimony of the Christian church until just the last maybe 150 years when we embraced Gnostic dualism, a hyper-division between the body and the spirit that disregards the body. All right. This is next week, which will actually be session 4. But I want to pause here. We have about 10 minutes. And I want to think through, some of you have your notebooks, I want to think through a couple of the questions that you have there. So I want somebody just to turn to the, you're at the end of the, of this section, and turn it over and just somebody read question number 1. Okay, we talked about this early on last week. But what I want to do is take that question and apply it a different way. Do you know anybody in your normal pedestrian where you actually have a relationship and some insight into how they process life and death? Do you know anybody who is not a dualist? Do you know anybody, actually know anybody who doesn't believe there's an immaterial part of the human being, whether they're a believer or not, but has that reality of the I and the me that is more than what you see? Do you know anybody personally that's a monist? Any of you? It's really extremely rare. Do you know anybody? Jessica, were you? Yeah, now this question, so let me take that, because you will meet lots of people, especially unbelievers, who want to believe and have perhaps convinced themselves that this life is all there is, that when I die, I'm dust. But this question is not going that. This question is going to, as they live, Do you know anybody who doesn't have this innate sense that there's an immaterial part of them, even if they believe that's going to die and go to dust? That's what this question's driving toward, because a monist wouldn't just address death. A monist also has a perception of what it means to be a human while you're alive, and that's really where I was kind of picking. I don't know anybody, and it's not a test. I'm just wondering if you've ever met anybody who really believes that we're just physical, that everything about us is organic, that all our emotions, expressions, personalities, thoughts, desires, wills, convictions are born out of our brain, and that there is no immaterial part of us. I don't know anyone like that. Apparently you don't either. Let's look at question number two. Somebody read question number two. It's a good question. You would all say, if I asked you to raise your hand, is everybody in here a dualist? You pretty much said it already, because you said you never met a monist, and I'm assuming you've met yourself in the mirror. So you're all dualists. So what experience in your life would affirm that? Not biblical conviction, experience. So if you give credibility to those, that would certainly be something. All of us have had some exposure to that, either news media or read a book or whatever. That would clearly argue that there seems to be this experience of us or part of us outside our body. Many are skeptical of those experiences, but nonetheless, it's a valid observation. What about your personal experience? Personal experience. Well, while you're living, don't you have... What I'm really looking for is that you have a personal sense that there's a part of you that's not physical, that's spiritual.
Thinking?
Yeah, just thinking itself. This is really where a philosophical perspective of anthropology takes you. It's a consideration of how a human shapes a thought. Where does it come from? What's its genesis? Because it's very, very hard, scientifically or philosophically, to argue that that has a birth in the human brain, that matter creates that. So the idea of thinking argues that there's something in you that is the genesis of thought. That's the genesis of idea. That's the genesis of every decision you make. If you're confronted with whether to eat the steak or eat the carrots, that's an easy one for me. I don't even have to think about that one. But what is it that makes that decision? Do you think that's just a function of your brain? But you're defining something else, right? That's what I'm really talking about. I think you all have personal experience that would argue that there's something there that's not organic, that's inexplicable, inextricably linked. And, in large measure, as you view your life, is far more significant in your thinking, in your practice, than your physical nature is. It weighs heavier, and certainly among believers. So that's what this question's reaching for, in your personal experience. So let's say you're sitting with somebody, and you know, Michael probably be doing this in his math class, suddenly springing off into an anthropological discourse and is confronted with a monist suggestion, and he would say, no, my personal experience would argue contrary, and I'm just wondering if you have experiences like this. And the best one, this is my argument, the best one is the one that Brent tiptoed us into. Ask another human being where his thoughts come from. Where does that come from? What's the genesis of an idea or a thought? Certainly would. And there's much of this that we've already covered back in the doctrine of God. Like, how do we know there's a God? And there is that same argument as she read in question one. There's this innate, universal expression of all people everywhere that there's something else. So we're just trying to nail that down into our persons. Now, does somebody else have an observation there, Kevin? No, the conditional unity would argue that in this life we are complete in our parts, and in the life to come we are incomplete, those parts being separated. Now, that may have been written that way, but no, that position would embrace dichotomy, most traditionally, some trichotomists, because those would not find deference in the conditional unity. It's not arguing that in this life there are no parts, but it is arguing that in this life we're complete. I'm looking at complete humans. That's a good question, because I probably left that unclear. Let's read another question. We've got about 6 minutes. Now, we read this story already, right? Which does it support? Monism, dualism? Dualism, clearly. Something's going on, but also supports not only absent from the body to be present from the Lord, and this is something we haven't delved into much. What does it mean to be absent from the body as an unbeliever? Where are you present? And that story gives us some insight that there's a place of misery, a place of torment, But where are you? And what we will talk about as we press into further down into systematic theology and we talk about the doctrine of hell, your inclination is to say the unbeliever, when he dies, his soul is in hell. And that would be wrong, unless you define hell. Because hell, as we typically speak of it, is really best answered or termed the lake of fire. And ain't nobody's there yet. But there is this place, it seems, this maybe abyss, this darkness, where the souls of those who have died outside the Lord experience a measure of travail and turmoil, not to be equated with the lake of fire. Separate from the Lord, certainly. Out of the presence of the Lord. But the question is, where? Well, we offered that up and we didn't resolve it. Because you would have to say the same thing also, that his observation was the same of Lazarus, that he was enjoying physical sensation. And we didn't press that. That text is tough in all different directions, not the least of which is whether it's a parable. If it's a parable, we don't have to answer all that. If it's not a parable or is an actual narrative of what that is like, it raises questions that historic Christianity has no answers for. In what sense do we have physical temptation, desire, pain, or even blessing absent our body? Yes. Next question. 3 minutes. Yeah, that's important on lots of levels. So one is that would be a common experience, right? You're suffering and you turn to the Lord. But in the context of this class and that question, there is in some sense the acknowledgement that what I'm suffering might be spiritual. That what I'm suffering might be a lack of you or too much of me. So something to really think about, this question. In what ways do we realize the effect of a despair of our soul or anguish, and how that might be affecting our physical body, or conversely? Remember when the disciples were confronted from a Jewish context with our Lord's healing of the blind man, their obvious connection was what? His physical condition was connected to his spiritual condition. That was their obvious understanding. Now, they were corrected in their false assumption, but they were not corrected in a sense that would suggest there's no way there's a connection, because the Apostle Paul would later teach there is a connection, that some sickness is the result of sin. That means that a spiritual reality is affecting you physically and God is engaged in that. Not all sickness is a result of sin. Some sickness is a result of sin. If the sickness that you're experiencing is the result of sin, repentance that precedes or introduces into your life grace will end the sickness. See James chapter 5. It'll end. So when you're visiting the sick as a minister, obviously we're concerned about what? Their physical condition. We are responding to a physical reality, but we go there to minister to their spirit, maybe to encourage them to endure the suffering, and the pain won't last forever, and one day you'll be absent from this body. All those things kind of rush in. But a faithful minister, a faithful believer, is not effectively ministering to them unless you find some sense in which you can ask them to consider their own spiritual condition, which might be connected to their physical condition. You need to tell them the truth about sin and its effects, or together celebrate that by God's grace that's not what this is, but it needs to be in the conversation, or you just haven't effectively ministered to anybody once you understand what it means to be a human. And that spirit and physical are connected. And now we're out of time. These questions are intended to kind of help us see if we can put some thoughts together rather than listening to my rambling thoughts. But next week, fascinating. Where does the soul come from? And when does it come? And it's very relevant. It's very relevant because it comes up, as so many things do tend to, at least in 21st century Christianity. It is relevant to the discussion, any discussion of abortion or infanticide or euthanasia. And that makes it very relevant to us today in the recent death this past week of a Supreme Court justice and the considerations and the implications of that. So where does the soul come from and when does it come is a very, very important question. All right, you're dismissed.